Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how unions lost momentum in America after shaping the nature of employment for decades. We'll spend this hour with veteran journalist Stephen Greenhouse, whose new book examines the rise of organized labor and the effect it had on conditions many of us take for granted at work. 40-hour weeks, paid sick days, safe job sites, and vacation time. As Greenhouse will explain, the bygone era of great factory jobs didn't happen on its own. The benefits we pine for were a direct result of worker campaigns for better conditions and compensation, and those changes also influenced the expectations for employers in non-unionized sectors. Our conversation starts after a short break. Not to long for the halcyon days of the good factory job. Maybe your parents or grandparents lived it when a good work ethic and a high school diploma were all one needed to get a job that would land a family squarely in the middle class. Decent wages, health insurance, maybe a modest vacation every summer. And then after half a century or so on an assembly line somewhere, enough of a nest egg to retire on. There are lots of reasons the world no longer works that way, but we often fail to appreciate the role of organized labor in making it possible in the first place. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Stephen Greenhouse was a reporter for the New York Times from 1983 until 2014. These days, he's focused on long-form projects. Greenhouse would remind us that just over a century ago, manufacturing jobs were terrible jobs, exploitative, often dangerous. That changed as unions came together across sector after sector, changing the balance of power between workers and employers and yielding benefits for laborers across the board. And he says the decline in worker outcomes today is not coincidentally related to the steep drop-off in the power of unions. He explains all this in his new book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. He joins us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about it. Steve, welcome to Think.
Great to be here, Chris.
Really, if there is one thing that I will take away from this book, it's the understanding that factory jobs did not start out as good jobs at all. What was the work like before unions came together to represent manufacturing labor?
So factory jobs were pretty terrible. They were unsafe. People sometimes had to work 16 hours, work 12 hours. Maybe you wouldn't get paid for all the hours you worked. And people were really, really unhappy. And then, you know, things got even worse during the Great Depression when so many people were laid off and those who remained on jobs were, like, pushed to work even harder. You know, at some factories, you know, the boss would lay off longtime people and then maybe offer to take them back at two-thirds the wage. And you know, sometimes factory bosses would say, if you want to keep your job, you got to mow my lawn, you got to do that. Mm. So, and people would give gifts to their boss, to their supervisor, to, like, ingratiate themselves. And people felt really, you know, beaten down, as my book says. And that really changed during the Depression with the rise of organized labor. And a lot of workers realized that for us to improve our lot and make lives better for our families, you know, there's strength in numbers. And they banded together and formed unions.
Unions also played a role in the passage of universal benefits that we all enjoy, Social Security, Medicare, minimum wage, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. So now there's this big debate about Medicare for all single payers. Should we get rid of insurance companies? And will that mean an end to unions, employer-sponsored health coverage? And there's a big debate. You know, Joe Biden has been fighting with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren about that. But, you know, going back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1930s, there were proposals for universal health insurance. And after World War II, Britain adopted National Health Service universal health coverage, and the American labor movement was hoping that the American Congress would do the same. But Republicans won control of Congress in 1946. Labor leaders saw they didn't have a prayer getting Congress to do that. So then they started pushing employers to start creating good health plans for workers. And that, you know, out of that push by unions in the late 1940s and 1950s, we got these quite good employer-based health plans. But now, you know, healthcare has gone haywire. You know, when unions represented 35% of workers rather than 10% of workers today, you know, it was easier to get good union health plans. But health costs have gone crazy for many, many reasons, not because of unions. And there's this big debate now about whether we should go to universal health coverage, a single payer, or keep what we have now.
So you said that there's only about 10% of American workers are unionized today. But how do those union members fare better than non-union workers in similar jobs on average?
Good question. It's one of the great untold, unappreciated stories in America, in my view, over the past half century, is that the percentage of workers who belong to unions, it used to be 1 in 3, and now it's just 1 in 16 in the private sector. And, you know, academic studies, statistics show that generally unionized workers have, you know, their pay is 15% to 20% better. They're far more likely to have health coverage. They're far more likely to have employer-based retirement plans. They get more paid vacations. They get more paid sick days. And, you know, a lot of workers, you know, support unions and want a union. One of the things I discovered in researching the book is this new study by folks at MIT saying that 1 in 2 non-union workers says that they would like to join a union, would vote for a union if they could. Yet only, you know, 10.5% of workers are in a union. So, like, what gives? Why do 50% of workers say they want to be in a union? And why are only 10% in a union? And as I say in my book, I think the main reason by far is that American corporations fight so hard to keep out unions. And I strongly believe that corporations in America fight far harder to keep out unions than corporations in any other industrial country. And that, I believe, is, you know, one of the reasons, you know, things are arguably bad for American workers in many ways. You know, wages compare favorably with many other countries, but American workers don't have many of the basic protections and rights that workers have in other nations. I explain in the book that, you know, we are the only advanced industrialized nation not to guarantee paid maternity leave, paid parental leave for every worker. We are the only industrialized country that doesn't guarantee paid vacations for workers. In the 28 nations of the European Union, every worker is guaranteed 4 weeks vacation. Of all the industrial nations, we in South Korea are the only ones that don't guarantee paid sick days. I've interviewed workers who lost their jobs because they took a day off sick, or because their kid got sick and they needed to stay home. And again, we're the only industrialized country that doesn't have universal health coverage. That means if you're a worker and you're laid off, you and your family can lose health coverage. If you work for a factory in Texas or Ohio, and it closes and 1,000 people laid off, 1,000 people could lose health coverage. And we're the only industrialized country in the world where that can happen.
Yeah, you mentioned Texas. This, of course, is a right-to-work state. Explain what that means and what the effect is on the strength of union activity in right-to-work states.
Thanks for asking that, Chris. So right-to-work is a law that exists in about half the states that says if your workplace is unionized, you can't be required to pay any dues or fees to the union that represents you. And so unions hate that because it means that workers at unionized workplaces, you know, workers for whom you bargain, for whom you might, who might get fired and you have to handle a grievance process for them, maybe hire lawyers to try to get them their job back, that they don't have to pay any dues or fees to the union. So unions are losing money because of this right to work. And they call these workers who you know, benefit from the union but don't pay any money to the union, they call them free riders. So the Republican Party in the United States has sought in recent years to weaken labor unions. And that's why we saw in numerous states in recent years, Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan, Kentucky, West Virginia, as soon as Republicans took control of the state legislatures, they moved to enact right-to-work laws. In Kentucky, the legislature flipped to all Republican control for the first time since the Great Depression. The very first bill they passed, pushed by the Koch brothers and other conservatives, was a right-to-work bill. And I argue that it was very much to weaken unions because a lot of conservatives hate unions because unions often support stronger social safety net, more spending for education, more spending for Social Security, more spending for unemployment insurance. And that can mean higher taxes. And a lot of folks say, a lot of conservatives say, you know, they're allergic to the idea of higher taxes. And unions often embrace many of the same positions as Democrats, which want a stronger safety net, which want to protect workers from the vicissitudes, the vagaries of a often cruel or volatile job market, you know, people who suddenly get laid off.
So how does the lobbying power of unions in the 21st century compare with the lobbying power of corporations and industries?
Thanks for asking. So I was surprised looking at some recent polls, basically 80 to 20, you know, margin 3-1, 4-1, Americans support a law that would require paid sick days. They would support a law that would require paid parental leave. They, you know, by like 3-1, they support a higher minimum wage. Yet none of these ideas have a snowball's chance in hell in passing Congress nowadays. So why is that? And in my book, I argue that it's because our system is so skewed in favor of corporations and wealthy donors. So you ask, oh, how do you know that? So in the last election cycle, 2015-2016, business, corporate America outspent labor 16-1. Business donated $3.4 billion to campaigns, while labor donated $213 million. And in lobbying in Washington, unions spent $48 million last year, while corporate America spent over 60 times as much. They spent over $3 billion. So one might ask, well, why was it that Congress, Republicans in Congress, rushed to pass these huge tax cuts for the rich and for corporations when corporations, corporations were already making record profits, when the stock market was already at record levels, yet Congress rushed to do big favors for business while Congress sits on its hands and does nothing to raise the minimum wage? The minimum wage has lost, a lot of value since it was last increased 10 years ago. The United States has gone for the longest time in its history without raising the federal minimum wage. The federal minimum wage was first enacted in 1938, and never before have we as a nation gone a whole decade without raising the federal minimum wage. And people will say, well, do we really need to raise the minimum wage? And you know, another statistic that really shocked me is, you know, the Federal Reserve, you know, issued a report this year saying that 40% of American families say that if they face an unexpected, unanticipated bill of $400, they're unable to pay it unless they borrow money or unless they sell something. That's quite startling to realize that, you know, we think, oh, Americans are also prosperous, but a lot of Americans are really struggling. You know, 1 in 4 Americans skipped necessary medical care sometime last year because they couldn't afford the cost. And I was also amazed that, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, 40 million Americans, 1 in 8, suffers from so-called food insecurity, meaning they face a lack of consistent access to enough food for an active, healthy life. So, the point I'm making, Chris, is that, America is a wonderful country. It's the richest country in the world. You know, with the free market system, we've made huge gains in increasing wealth and increasing prosperity. But the wealth is not distributed fairly enough. And unions, certainly when they were at the strongest in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, helped make sure that corporate America distributed its bounty, its prosperity, its profits in a fairer way. And study after study, academic study after academic study shows that as unions have grown weaker, inequality has increased, not just in the United States, but in many other industrialized nations as well.
My guest is Stephen Greenhouse. He's a former reporter for The New York Times. These days, he works on long-form projects like his new book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor.
Funding for Think comes from Interabang Books, a locally owned shop with a hand-picked selection of books and gifts for adults and kids. In Dallas at the corner of Preston Road and Royal Lane and online at interabangbooks.com.
Thank you. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Stephen Greenhouse about his book that covers the decline in the power of American labor unions. It's called Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Steve, you say that, or you tell us that Walter Reuther was head of the United Auto Workers starting in the 1940s. You call him the builder of the American middle class. What did Reuther and his colleagues get done for auto workers and by extension for workers in other sectors of manufacturing in the United States?
I'm glad you asked that, Chris. So let's start in the Great Depression. The Great Depression, you know, one in four American workers was unemployed. One in six homes were foreclosed upon. You know, factories are closed. Workers, you know, were really scared to speak up to demand higher wages. Then they elected, you know, Americans elected Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Democrats to try to turn things around after the Depression started under Herbert Hoover. So FDR, the Democrats in Congress, passed enacted laws that make it easier to unionize. And there was a real snowballing increase in unionization in the late 1930s and again in the during World War II. So now we come to World War II. So during the war, unions and American business worked closely together. They really worked hand in hand. They weren't enemies. They said, the enemy was the Nazis, and we got to really work together to defeat them. And they did. And after the war ended, workers were very frustrated because they really hadn't gotten many raises during the war. And there, in 1946, there was, you know, like over 1,000 strikes. It was crazy. Workers were so, you know, fed up and worked up. And so at the time, again, after World War II, we start the National Highway System, building highways, interstates all across the nation. The suburbs are forming. People are moving out of the big cities. People, after millions of American soldiers, you know, were overseas, they want prosperity. And at the time, European nations and Japan were fairly decimated because of the war. So General Motors wanted to expand very quickly because it saw that many more people were going to want to buy cars. But General Motors realized that if we want to expand our production by 50%, they have to worry about one thing, which was these big, long, painful strikes that the United Auto Workers held in the late 1940s. So Reuther, who came from West Virginia, his family of German immigrants, brilliant guy, visionary guy, you know, realized that General Motors is eager to grow. General Motors was, at the time, was the biggest and most profitable company in the world. So Reuther basically reached this treaty with the head of General Motors, Charlie Wilson, that we will promise not to go on strike if you agree to share a lot of your profits and prosperity with us big time. So they reached this trailblazing contracts that raised workers' wages after inflation by a full 20% over 5 years. And these were the really trailblazing agreements that created good employer-sponsored health care and good employer-sponsored pension plans. And this was a time when about 35% of the workforce was unionized. So, you know, when GM reached this landmark deal with Walter Reuther, all these other companies, you know, said, well, if GM did it, we got to do it too. It was kind of a copycat thing. And then in many of the businesses that were non-union, they wanted to keep out unions. And one thing they thought is that if we don't want to be unionized, if we want to keep out unions, then we have to start offering the same things that GM did. So wages increased massively in the 1950s and 1960s. Part of that was that American industry was really protected because there wasn't much foreign competition from Europe and Germany. And part of the reason wages went up so much was that unions were so strong and were able to demand what they saw as their fair share. All that changed in the 1980s, and we will discuss that.
Well, yeah, you know, I was a kid in the 1970s, and I remember there were milk strikes and transit strikes and garbage strikes. There were a lot. There was a lot of union activity by people who wanted better benefits, better pay, that sort of thing. It seems to me now, and maybe since the 80s, maybe I think we're about to talk about the Patco strike here, but there just isn't a lot of strike activity even among workers that are unionized.
So if you grew up in the, so you grew up in the 70s, Chris. Yeah. You remember that there was, you know, the oil shock, the oil embargo in 1973, and there was another oil shock in 1979, and that both of those sent inflation soaring, and President Nixon understandably ordered some wage freezes because he was worried that wages and prices are going out of control. And when you order a wage freeze, guess what? Unions are going to be upset. So there were a lot of strikes in the 1970s because inflation was very high and workers didn't think they were keeping up. So the 1970s were a mess. So come 1980. 1980 was in ways a really bad year because inflation was very high. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates to over 20% to slam the brakes on inflation. So we went into a very deep recession, the deepest recession since World War II, the deepest recession at the time since World War II. Plus, around 1980, 1982, that's when imports from Europe and Japan, Hondas were starting to come in, the Volkswagens were starting to come in, steel was starting to be imported in big ways. And so there was a lot of pressure on corporate America. Their profits were going down. They were really badly squeezed. And so, and then in 1981, in Ronald Reagan's first months as president, the air traffic controllers, union known as PATCO, were frustrated. You know, they thought they should be paid as much as airline pilots. And they wanted to go from a five-day week, from a four-day week, and still be paid as much as airline pilots. And their bargaining with the Reagan administration went very poorly. They went on strike, and they were federal employees, and federal employees pledged on their first day of work that they will never go on strike. So President Reagan fired them for engaging in an illegal strike. He fired 11,300 air traffic controllers. And President Reagan won the strike. The union was really vanquished. It was a real setback for labor. And at the time, corporate America was really reeling from the recession, from all these imports, and they wanted to really hold down costs. And they got into many big battles with unions, and unions would go on strike. And the corporate executives would say, why don't we do what President Reagan did? Why don't we just fire these workers and we'll hire other workers? And that was hardly ever done before 1980 to use so-called permanent replacement workers, firing the strikers. And that really changed in the 1980s. And that's why we saw, as you said, Chris, a huge decline in the number of strikes. In the 1970s, the average number of big strikes with more than 1,000 workers was 288 per year. Over the past decade, the number of strikes of more than 1,000 workers is just 13 a year. So we're less than 1/20th, less than 1/20th as much as in the 1970s.
One category of workers that does seem to go on strike and get notice is teachers. And you note here that teachers who have engaged in strikes in recent years often are lobbying as much for the rights of their students as for their own benefit.
Yes. So I have a full chapter about the teacher strikes because in many ways it is, one of the big, big developments in labor and worker power and labor strategy over the past few decades. And, so we saw these big teacher strikes last year in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, somewhat lesser ones in Kentucky and Colorado. And the teachers were just fed up. These are red states, except for Colorado, and the state legislatures were cutting taxes or giving big tax breaks to fossil fuel industries, and they were really freezing overall budgets, freezing education budgets. Teacher salaries were going nowhere. I interviewed this teacher outside Phoenix who said she hadn't gotten a raise in 10 years. I interviewed one of the leaders of the strike in Arizona, was just making $32,000, $33,000 a year as a teacher. And so the teachers, were just angry, that things are bad for them. Their schools are being starved. The schools weren't buying new textbooks. The ratios in some classes are like 35, 40 students to a teacher. And they went on strike not just to improve their wages, but to like really put their foot down and say something is really messed up here. The state legislatures are too busy cutting taxes and neglecting the schools. And we teachers who are respected members of the community, who have a lot of community support, we're going to go on strike to try to change the equation in the schools in our state.
I understand why managers, people who are looking at, you know, corporate profits might oppose unions. I'm not saying I approve of it, but I get it, right? There's a motivation for that. What I don't necessarily understand is why workers in the same industries who are not unionized seem to resent the benefits that their colleagues in unions are getting.
Certainly you're right, Chris, that many executives oppose unions. And I say there's this weird phenomenon in the United States that if you're the manager of a retail store, of a restaurant, and the workers successfully unionize, a majority of them vote to unionize, you, the manager, are going to look, you know, like an utter failure. Hmm. And there's a good chance you're going to get fired or demoted. So the managers fight very, very, very hard to keep out unions. And the top executives realize that if their company is unionized, they might have to pay higher wages, maybe provide better benefits. Their profits might go down somewhat. So they understandably oppose unions. Now, unions will argue that that unionization leads to less turnover, more employee loyalty. The workers end up, you know, upskilling, getting more skilled, getting more efficient, and they argue that unionization is good for companies. But executives say, and studies show, that unionization generally brings down profits somewhat. Now, we as a nation are in the situation where the percentage of national income going to business, going to corporations, is at its highest level since World War II, while the percentage of overall income going to workers, going to labor, is at its lowest level since World War II, and something is broken. Now, Chris, you mentioned non-union workers resenting union workers. I don't know if I agree so much on that, because I think a lot of non-union workers wish that they could unionize, but they're scared to stick their neck out. Hmm. Another surprising statistic I stumbled upon while researching the book is a study that said, you know, at a company where workers seek to unionize, the two or three or five or 10 workers who lead the effort, generally 20% of them get fired. And it's illegal under federal law to fire a worker for supporting a union. So that's what I mentioned before, like 50% of non-union workers say they want a union, but only 6.4% of 1 in 16 workers in private sector jobs have a union. I think the reason for that is corporations fight so hard against unions, and a lot of workers are just scared to stick their head up above the parapet and say, I want a union. I think that's changing somewhat, Chris, now because of the teacher strikes and successful strikes like the Stop and Shop strike in New England, and there's a series of hotel strikes against Marriott that were very successful. And I think workers are feeling, we face decades of wage stagnation. Finally, wages are going up in the last year or two because unemployment is so low. But, you know, workers feel very precarious. They feel very insecure. They see the corporations and the stock market doing well, and they don't feel they're keeping up. And I think there's something bubbling. The teacher strike was really kind of a match on, you know, this sea of oil where, you know, of worker discontent. And there's more worker restiveness, more worker militancy than there was 5 and 10 and 15 years ago.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Steve, when you describe, you know, companies, management fighting hard to keep unions from being established among their workers in the first place, how exactly do they do that if it's not legal for them, technically, to fire people for trying to unionize?
So the National Labor Relations Act, which gives American workers a right to unionize, they say if a majority of workers at a private sector workplace vote to unionize, the company has to recognize the union and is required to bargain with them. But the National Labor Relations Act, though, has no financial penalties when companies break the law. So if you fire a worker legally for supporting a union, or if you illegally spy on workers for supporting a union, you know, you can't be fined. The company really faces no penalty if it acts illegally. You know, I in my previous book, I wrote about a Walmart in Texas where the butchers were seeking to unionize, and where they talk about they were so scared of getting in trouble that the one place where they talked about a union was literally inside the freezer. And I interviewed, and I'm not making this up, I interviewed the security guard who said, I installed a video camera with sound inside the freezer so we could see who was saying what about a union. So companies work very, very, very hard to keep out unions. Something like 57% of unionization efforts, companies say, we might close our factory or operation if you vote to unionize. I talk about unionization, I think, at a company in Texas where the company, it was Fruit of the Loom in Texas, I think it's down near El Paso, they put up a banner saying, you know, vote for the union and become unemployed. Hmm. So, American companies really play hardball in fighting a union. And I have a whole section of the book also that not only do companies play hardball, but I have a section about the South and where governors and senators and congressmen and state senators and mayors, they don't want a union because they worry that's going to, quote, hurt their business climate, unquote. So, with Volkswagen in Tennessee, with Nissan in Mississippi, the governors really speak out and say, we don't want a union. Nikki Haley in South Carolina, when there was an effort to unionize Boeing in North Charleston. We don't want a union. She says, why do I wear high heels every day? It's to kick the union. And, the South is famous for not wanting to be unionized. And, there are growing efforts to try to unionize places in the South, but it's hard. And one of the phenomena I write about in the book is, so there are these non-union worker advocacy groups that are trying to help workers, because a lot of workers face barriers to unionize, but they need help with, job safety. They need help with unemployment insurance. And, one of the, best groups in the country on this is in Austin, the Workers' Defense Project. And they've done a terrific job improving safety standards and wages and winning workers more dignity on many of the construction projects in Austin, and they're trying to do work now in Houston and Dallas as well.
My guest is journalist Stephen Greenhouse. We're talking about his book, Beaten Down, Worked Up: The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Stephen Greenhouse. We're talking about his book, Beaten Down, Worked Up: The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Steve, you mentioned earlier that the South in particular has been resistant over the course of history to union activity. How much of that is about racial politics and the reality that unions are likely to offer the same benefits to people of color as to white people?
That's a tough question, Chris. The employment model in the South, is different from the North. It had, a horrible tradition of slavery for centuries. And I think a lot of Southern employers were used to treating their workers more harshly, less fairly. And unions were a very important tool, weapon to ensure that workers were paid more and treated more fairly. And that was not so much in the tradition of the South. And part of it was, I think, some employers didn't want to pay, their African-American workers so much. And they saw unions were really a tool to help, especially African-American workers who are often the most exploited. We were talking before about, business executives resenting unions because unions reduce profits. Well, union leaders, not just union leaders, a lot of politicians, a lot of Americans at large say something is broken in America. There's been wage stagnation for years when the corporate profits and the stock market are record levels. The percentage of income going to workers is the lowest since World War II. CEOs are making 312 times as much as the average worker. That's up from just 20 times in 1965. It used to be that when employee productivity rose. You know, employee compensation basically rose at the exact same rate. That was the case in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And then over the past few decades, employee productivity rises six times as much as employee compensation. So workers are not getting nearly as much of the benefit when they increase productivity. So something is broken. And, you know, a lot of employers, whether in the South or in the North, say, you know, we don't want this. We don't want unions. You know, we're all about maximizing our share price. We're all about maximizing profits. And unions might gum up the works and get in the way. And the unions say, wait a second, you know, we need a fair economy. We want to ensure fair wages for everybody. And, you know, let's not forget, Chris, that, you know, there have been some big problems with unions. Mm-hmm. They discriminate against women for decades. They discriminate against African Americans, Hispanics, Asian Americans for decades. There was way too much corruption. In my book, I really hammer union corruption. I think it's despicable, and it betrays workers, and it needs to stop. But, you know, unions, I argue, despite their flaws, are the, you know, most effective weapon for lifting wages and creating a fairer economy. I quote, you know, if you allow me, Dr. Martin Luther King saying, "The labor movement was the principal force that transformed misery and despair into hope and progress. Out of its bold struggles, economic and social reform gave birth to unemployment insurance, old age pensions, government relief for the destitute, and above all, new wages, new wage levels that meant not mere survival, but a tolerable life. The captains of industry did not lead this transformation. They resisted it until they were overcome." But a lot of folks in business say it's thanks to us that American workers are doing very well. And unions, you know, call them out on that and say, you know, you were very, very grudging in giving workers what they deserved. And it was only because of the union movement that you were forced to really begin to share your prosperity in an adequate way.
You say that President Trump's appointees to the National Labor Relations Board have moved aggressively to undermine organized labor. How have they done that specifically?
Sure. So one area where I agree with President Trump is, you know, he campaigned saying the system is rigged. And I agree that the system is rigged. It's rigged against workers. And he was right about that. And I think one of the reasons he won, one of the big reasons he won, is that, you know, blue-collar workers, you know, in Texas, in Ohio, in the three key states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, sympathize with him because they felt they were being taken advantage of. But unfortunately, I believe, you know, ever since President Trump took office, he's been repeatedly favoring business over workers. And his appointees to the federal courts and to the National Labor Relations Board have repeatedly taken pro-business, anti-worker, anti-union actions. So specifics. So Uber, you know, there's a big debate about whether Uber and Lyft drivers should be considered employees with a right to unionize or whether they should be considered independent contractors. And if you're an independent contractor, you're considered a businessman and you can't unionize. That's considered, you know, an antitrust violation, businessmen banding together in conspiracy and restraint of trade. So the President Trump's appointees to the NLRB have said that, you know, Uber drivers, Lyft drivers are employees without the right to unionize. Under President Obama, he made it the Democratic appointees to the labor board made it easier for the small units in a department store, say the 40 workers in the perfume department or the shoe department of a department store, certain units of a hospital, they might be able to unionize separately from the whole store. And President Trump's appointees have taken, you know, have voted to take away that right. And whole, you know, so the fight for 15, which is, we haven't talked about that. I have a whole big chapter about that, which is just, you know, a really impressive organizing pro-worker effort that has ended up, you know, it started with a strike by 200 workers in New York City in 2012. And as a result of the fight for 15, over 22 million workers have gotten raises. So,
excuse me, just for interrupting. Yeah. This is the fight for a $15 minimum wage.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Chris. And so, there's been a desire to unionize some fast food workers, but, you know, a lot of the, you know, McDonald's and Burger King's are run by franchisees. You know, this franchisee owns six restaurants. This one owns seven. So the unions really want to like unionize all the McDonald's in New York City, or all the McDonald's in Dallas, or all the Burger Kings in Houston, and they want these franchised operations to be called joint employers, so that McDonald's and Burger King would be considered just as much of an employer. Also for wage violations and for sexual harassment things, and the Bush appointees both in the Labor Department. And in the Bush, I mean Trump appointees in the Labor Department and the NLRB both, say that you can't consider McDonald's a joint employer with its franchisees, and that will make it much harder.
What is worth paying attention to as presidential candidates talk about labor issues? Is talking about job creation and minimum wage the same thing as talking about labor issues and labor conditions?
Yes. I mean, so candidates have often talked about raising the minimum wage, but I see something different this time. And maybe because there's so many candidates that some have gonna, when there are just two candidates, 10 candidates are going to talk about unions. But now we hear many, many candidates talking up unions, saying they're going to help unions. Elizabeth Warren said she'd appoint a union leader to be Secretary of Labor. I think two things are going on here. When there are two dozen candidates, you're looking for every edge to try to get ahead. So a lot of folks are wooing labor because labor is an important constituency in the Democratic Party. But second, and I think more important, is after the Democrats got their heads handed to them in 2016 by losing these three longtime union strongholds, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, they realized, hey, we got to do something to strengthen unions, because if we as a party want to win in our old industrial base in the Middle West, we need stronger unions. And in my book, I argue that one of the reasons Hillary Clinton lost those three key states was that union density, union membership in those states has declined so much. In Wisconsin alone, the percentage of workers in unions has dropped by 43%, by 166,000 in the past decade, and Hillary lost Wisconsin by 22,000 votes. So one could imagine that if Wisconsin hadn't lost 160,000, that the unions there hadn't lost 166,000 members, and the unions were communicating with those 166,000 during the 2016 campaign and telling them why Hillary, was arguably better than Trump, maybe, Hillary Clinton would have won Wisconsin, and ditto with Michigan and Pennsylvania, which also lost more than 100,000 union members each in recent years.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You cite the Culinary Workers Union Local in Las Vegas as a really effective organization, but one that might not be scalable to other markets. Can you talk about what makes it effective and why its results may not be easily duplicated in other cities?
Thanks for asking. Great question. So I was just out in Las Vegas 2 weekends ago giving some speeches about my book. And this union, we talk about how the labor movement has declined, how it's gone from 35% to 10, 11%. But the story is just totally the opposite in Las Vegas. There's the huge union representing the hotel, casino, restaurant workers there. And it's gone from having 18,000 in the 1980s to having 60,000 now.
Wow.
And in many cities, hotel housekeepers average $11 an hour. In Las Vegas, they average $19 an hour. So, I write about this hotel housekeeper who makes $19.53 an hour. She's in the middle class. She supports, three kids on her own. The man in her life was a construction worker from Honduras, during the Great Recession, construction work stopped in Las Vegas, and he moved back to Honduras. So Frances is raising three kids on her own with a housekeeper's salary. She's bought a Toyota Camry. She has a two-bedroom apartment. She has a beautiful large TV. She has a beautiful large couch. She doesn't have to pay a cent in premiums for health coverage. This union has done a great job growing and exercising its collective power to raise standards for workers. Why can't other unions do that? Partly, they're not as efficient, as visionary, as smart about how to involve people and grow. partly, you know, the casino industry is a little more profitable than a lot of other businesses. So they have more money to play around with, you know, higher profits to share with their workers. But one of the signal things about the culinary union is they're powerful enough to ensure that the casinos share their prosperity, which we're not seeing so much at many, many other companies. And another big and the culinary union made a huge difference. So when we saw Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania flip from blue to red in 2016, Nevada flipped from red to blue. And that's largely because, I explained, is that the culinary union does such a great job communicating with its workers, telling them why the Democrats and Obamacare will be better for them than the Republicans. And it also does a marvelous job mobilizing its members to work in the campaign. The culinary union knocked on 350,000 doors. In 2018, Nevada was the only state where an incumbent Republican senator lost to a Democrat. So the culinary is a model in many ways, but it's hard to imitate, partly because a lot of industries are not quite as profitable as the casino industry. And also, a lot of unions don't have the visionary, smart leadership that the culinary union has. And if more unions had really smart leadership that involved their members and inspired their members and mobilized their members, it would make a big difference. I just attended the memorial service for one of New York City's best labor leaders, Hector Figueroa. And he under him over the past decade, his union grew by 50,000 members. They organized 15,000 airport workers, and they've done a great, great job. And I kept thinking, if there was someone like Hector Figueroa heading all these unions around the country, it would be a very different union movement, but it would probably be a very different nation, because leaders like that would change the conversation in the nation.
Are unions good at cultivating young leadership?
Not terribly. I think a lot of union, I'm sorry to say, Chris, I think a lot of union leaders don't want to bring in young, idealistic, very smart, perhaps smarter than they are, people who might challenge them. Hmm. I think, sadly, too many union leaders, want to have comfortable lives and not get upset, not get challenged, not get pushed. And I think they're also worried that if they bring in really smart young leaders, those leaders might challenge them and run for the presidency. But I'm not saying that, there are greater efforts than before to bring in and cultivate young leaders, but I don't think there's nearly enough. And I think too many unions are just seen as too hidebound and not visionary enough. And that's why a place like the culinary does attract young leaders, because people see that it is really kicking butt in many ways, and it's an exciting place and has improved lives for tens of thousands of workers.
The new book by Stephen Greenhouse is called Beaten Down, Worked Up: The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Steve, thanks so much for spending this hour with us.
Great to be here, Chris. Pleasure.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at KERA Think. Use any podcast app to subscribe to the Think podcast and find out about upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.